Here it comes, fellas, the AEF Jukebox of the Air, G.I. Jive. Hiya, men. It's time for the jump and the jam now, so gather round, all you Yanks that hail from Roanoke to Kokomo, for a generous helping of the hidey-ho. And to make today a sort of super occasion, we have as your CO in charge of Jive and such, that charmer and 18-carat heart alarmer, the Reveille gal, Beverly. Beverly, the music's here, the jukebox is stuffed to the cuffs, and the Yanks all around the world are waiting for the words and music now.
Well, thanks, Lou Crosby, and hi there, men from the USA. We're ready with the stuff that makes you swing and sway. The first little swingaroo is guaranteed to get you in the mood for more. I've dropped my nickel, the button has been pushed, the record is going round and round, and the music comes out here.
Good afternoon. This is Ron Yates, sitting in for Celeste Quinn and the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, as you might have heard there, if you didn't already recognize her voice, is a woman named Jean Hay, better known as Beverly, as in Reveille with Beverly. You know, World War II was famous for a lot of radio disc jockeys who were hired to broadcast propaganda to various governments. There was Axis Sally from Germany, who was taking over from Japan, though. It was more myth than reality, but that is another story for another show. But perhaps the most famous female voice beaming to GIs from America was that of Jean Hay, better known during World War II as Beverly, as I said before, as in Reveille with Beverly. This was a show of music and patter designed to lift the spirits of American soldiers, sailors, and pilots all around the world. And Jean, a.k.a. Beverly, is generally regarded as the world's first global radio personality. And at its peak, the show was broadcast in 54 countries from North Africa to Europe to Asia. In fact, during World War II, Beverly was voted by the Army Air Corps as the girl we'd most like to be caught in the lower turret of a B-17 with. That's an interesting distinction. So I'm pleased to have with us today the Jean Hay, otherwise known as Beverly. She's talking to us from her home in Northern California. Hello, Jean, or should I say Beverly?
Either one. How about Beverly?
Okay, Beverly. Let's go with Beverly.
I'm delighted to be on your magazine.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. I just wondered, to kind of get things rolling here, maybe you could give us a little background about how you started your Reveille with Beverly radio show in October, I guess, of 1941.
Right.
And it was a way, I guess, to interview troops at Fort Logan near Denver, Colorado, even before World War II started back in October, right?
Correct.
And that after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, your show suddenly took on a whole new dimension. Tell us a little about that, what happened, and how you got into it.
Well, that attack, that Pearl Harbor attack, as it's approaching now very closely, is so similar in many ways to what has happened to our country on September the 11th. Suddenly, everything changed. And our country was actually attacked. The patriotism is so similar. The fact that everyone is alert, horrified by the surprise, but also so patriotic that it's really hard to believe. Everyone's life seems to change overnight.
Mm-hmm.
It's really the way I got started. I was living in Boulder, Colorado, and some of my friends were coming home from their 6 weeks of basic training, and they were sort of proud of themselves. They stood a little taller and they wore their uniforms, but they all had this terrible complaint about what the bugler did to them at 5:30 every morning.
Oh, I remember that well.
You do?
Yes, I was in the Army, but not during that period, but a little bit later on.
Uh-huh. Anyway, I loved music. I'd always listened to the radio as a kid. And I had a recording by Benny Goodman of Bugle Call Rag. And I remembered how the bugler, at the start of that record, played Reveille, but it was soft. It was nice. And it led into this wonderful swing music by the King of Swing's band. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if we could get that sound into the barracks somehow? Well, it was just a dream. I never thought it would happen, but it did. Somehow, we worked it out in Denver and later carried the whole thing out to Hollywood and to troops everywhere.
It's the way you introduced this, I felt was very significant in light of what's just happened in last month. So you see some similarities in our country between December 7th, 1941, and September 11th, 2001. Is that right?
Very, very many. The surprise, the shock, the disbelief, and the change of everyone's life within minutes of hearing about it.
There was fear then. There's fear now.
Lots of fear, especially on the North Coast here in California, where little tiny Japanese submarines were spotted more than once roaming up and down our coast. But the thing about Pearl Harbor was that there were some Japanese ministers conferring in Washington, D.C. with some of our people. And while they obviously didn't know that it was coming, but that made it almost doubly shocking.
Now, you eventually moved from Denver to L.A., and there you were broadcasting over KNX, which is a CBS affiliate in Hollywood, right? And that was a 50,000 clear channel station. That's a pretty big station.
Well, even before it was picked up by others, like the Armed Forces Radio, just over KNX alone, 50,000 watts, it went clear to the Midwest and all the way from Alaska down to the fighting area in Subic Bay in the Philippines. And it had amazing coverage.
Well, that's amazing. So it actually reached that far?
Yes.
Oh, that's amazing.
And then Armed Forces Radio Service started recording my show, my 0530 military time. They started recording that ad-lib show that I did and sending it to farther away places overseas. But later, they also, President Roosevelt ordered, he put a whole lot of money into this, and ordered that the Armed Forces Radio Service form its own production company.
Uh-huh.
So it's a little bit complicated, but I then started recording for AFRS at their own studios on Vine Street. And so I was actually doing two very similar shows, only theirs was called G.I. Jive, and the story was, the script was pretty much not written for me, but I was pretty much told what to talk about, and they selected records too.
Now,
later, a couple of years later, after having done G.I. Jive all this time, I learned that my broadcasts were being used as coding and being picked up overseas. There was the white coding, which meant this is for real, this is what we want you to believe. I'm not sure how they segregated it. And the black coding was for misleading the enemy. And I only found that out fairly recently.
That's interesting. Now, so, in other words, U.S. intelligence services were using your broadcast as a way to communicate with their operatives out abroad someplace?
Yes, and actually, Bill Paley, the senior Bill Paley, was one of the most active people in the country for coding.
Well, that's, and so you say that so these they carry these coded messages. Now, was it I understand the coded messages went to what, to the French underground just before D-Day?
Yes, French underground, particularly before D-Day.
And when did you discover this, and how was it done? I mean,
Dean Opperman, who's been my producer, is a great, he's a historian for that era and a magnificent researcher, and he has dug up, we've been at this for a couple of years or more, and he's dug up everything he could possibly reach. When he went to Washington to get some of my old recordings from the Library of Congress, he happened to sit next to Bill Paley Jr. at lunch, and Bill Paley said, oh, well, she was certainly being recorded then, because that's what my father did. That's what G.I. Jive was for.
We're talking with Beverly Jean Hay, whose show Reveille with Beverly was perhaps the most listened to show during World War II by G.I.s all over the world. If you'd like to join in our conversation, You can do so by calling here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, 333-9455. Or if you're calling from another area, it's 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Now, you said earlier, Beverly, that your show began around 5:30 in the morning?
Yes, it was an hour. At military time, they call it 0530 to 0630.
And did you do this every day or 5 days a week? Or
six days a week. Everybody worked 6 days a week. And some people held several jobs.
How did you prepare for this?
I did on the air. I had other programs, too. Everybody woke up every morning thinking, what can I do for the war effort? It surprised me in some of the research that's been done that without actually coming out and saying so, most of the leading military men said that we were still losing the war in late 1943. And after going in late 1941, the most powerful nation in the world, that was quite a surprise to me to learn that.
Well, that was a shock, I suspect.
I guess actually D-Day had to be the turning point.
Uh-huh. Now, how did you prepare for the show? What did you do to prepare for...
Very little. That for my show in the morning.
Sound like me.
No preparation.
Uh-huh.
I just sat down with a stack of records, most of the ones that the servicemen had requested by mail, and read excerpts from their often very funny letters. And it was an ad lib, and at the very start, the first day of the show, I think, in Denver, they were new recruits. The war hadn't started yet. And I was new on the radio, so we just kind of learned our craft together.
Mm-hmm.
It was not I didn't feel like an entertainer talking out to our fighting men. We were sort of in this together. It was very, I won't say folksy, it was an intimate relationship.
Mm-hmm. And you got, how many letters did you get each week?
Oh, well, after I got to CBS, there were thousands.
And were you able to read them all? Or did you have somebody helping you read these?
Yes, and I answered each one that I possibly could. I had postcards printed, and then I would put my own signature personally on them. And the pictures that I sent out led to one of the saddest stories that I can think of. First was a small picture of me looking very young, which I was, in a pinafore dress. And it had printed on it, "Best wishes, Beverly." And then I wrote, "Good luck, Hal," or Leon, or whoever the person was. And they were small enough to fit into the breast pockets of the various uniforms. Well, after seeing Searching for Private Ryan, Saving Private Ryan, I couldn't go to the theater and look at that. It was going to be too difficult. But we rented the film and showed it at home in segments. And when we got to the point, the terrible, critical move when this bridge had to be saved by our men, outnumbered by the German tanks which were approaching, and they showed the picture of the slaughter, and men were lying on the ground, and some of them were reaching, who were still alive, reaching in their pockets for a picture and looking at it. And that told me, it solved a mystery for me, because often during the war, and especially after D-Day, I would get a picture of myself in the mail signed to Hal or David or Tom or whatever. And so that, I think, was taken from dead soldiers, and there was no return address, no mention of who sent it to me, but it just magically came to Beverly, and they usually said CBS or Los Angeles. Either way, it would get to me.
So,
and I saved some of those.
Well, that's the power that you have as a radio personality. It goes far beyond just introducing records, doesn't it?
Yes.
Well,
it does.
because GIs heard your broadcasts really just about in every theater of the war, right? I mean, because they were actually, as you said before, they were recorded, sent abroad, and then rebroadcast from local stations, right?
Yes, they went to North Africa, Asia, Malaysia, everywhere, Philippines. I just thought of something interesting. Oh, yes. They were, when AFRS sent them around, they were vinylite, big vinylite things. They were sent to little tiny radio stations. I have one from KSKA in Alaska. And these were able to be reduced to 50, instead of 50,000 watts, to 50-watt little recordings, which were moved ahead with the troops. It was broadcast from a tent or wherever they were living on the ground. And so it accompanied troops to their foxholes and their huts, wherever they were available. And so these were broken down, I guess, thousands and thousands of times. So my music and my voice went with the troops almost into battle.
Beverly,
I haven't known that before either.
That's amazing. I wonder if there's any, and I know, having been in the service myself, that you have Armed Forces Radio Network is still out there. And it's broadcasting both radio and television in Europe and in Asia. But I wonder if there's anything quite like what you did right now for the troops over in...
No, not that I've heard of, and I think I would have.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's a beginning of another career, Beverly.
Well, if I... My voice is a little foggy this morning, but usually...
Sounds good to me.
Does it?
Yeah, it does.
That's good. But I do have... I have stayed active in television and radio, and I work for a charity called Direct Relief, based in Santa Barbara, and I do recordings for them telling about our worldwide service in sending medical supplies and pharmaceuticals around the world.
Is that what that's what the organization does?
Yes.
And so you've spent a lot of your time devoted to humanitarian causes. Tell us a little more about that.
It was a natural transition for me because having worked overseas and working with people who were in great need, either for moral support or whatever, this was, I switched to, I lived in Santa Barbara and I switched to Direct Relief because it kind of filled that need, knowing how powerful radio can be. And we have served, by the way, I have a picture of me with the Dalai Lama. We've served the people escaping from Tibet into India, and we've served in Afghanistan several times in the past, and, you know, practically every country.
I'm going to ask you more about that, but before I do, let me give our listeners our number again in case you would like to call and join in the conversation with Beverly Jean Hay. It's 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And calling from another area, it's 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-9455. You just mentioned that you have a picture of yourself with the Dalai Lama, and also I think you've received awards from President Bush and the Dalai Lama. What were those awards, and why did you receive them?
That was for my work with Direct Relief. And my husband has been very active in that, too, raising funds. It's really the most... I shouldn't get in a plug on your show, but it is the most amazing charity.
Now, did you yourself go to Afghanistan or some of these places?
No, I didn't. I went to some earthquake locations, though, in this country. We served in this country, too.
Well, you know, you mentioned your husband.
Yes.
Your husband, was he in the military at the time that you were broadcasting?
Yes. Unfortunately, he didn't happen to be where he could hear my show.
Oh, he never heard you. Oh, I was going to ask him.
Not then. He's heard me a lot since. he has quite a story, but it would only take a few seconds. From the location was near Subic Bay in the Philippines. I'll put him on.
Sure.
John Hay.
John, welcome to the show.
I was given the job when I was stationed there at Subic Bay to carry a metal box containing pay for the sailors from my ship to the shore where they were supposed to be located. The helicopter took off with me and the Navy payroll of $300,000, which I had been ordered to deliver to shore. Enemy fire prevented our landing, so my metal box and I were lowered close to the water and then dropped in. I was not a good swimmer and now had to swim underwater as much as possible to avoid being shot. I was clutching the payroll box to my chest, and finally it slipped away. $300,000 in Navy pay to the ocean floor.
Whoa.
Whoa. Okay.
What year was that?
What year was that? About
40? 41 or 2.
42. It was 42.
Now, did you manage to get out of the Philippines without being captured by the Japanese?
Yes. He survived, and he played he played lots of tennis with General Halsey. That was one of his jobs over there.
Oh, really? Well, that's not
and
a bad job.
He would like to go for a drink at the top of the ravine, sort of, where the tennis court was set after playing tennis. And it must have meant a lot to him because Japanese were on the top of the bridge and shooting. So he got off fairly free. By the way, a regular bill from the War Department arrived at our house for years, and Congress finally passed a bill relieving John and other servicemen of these past obligations.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, well, that's. We mean they were actually trying to get you to come up with the $300,000 or something?
Well, I don't suppose they expected it, but it was, you know, part of the system.
Well, that's amazing.
The brass.
You know, Beverly, let's talk a little bit about your background and just talk about your film career. I mean, I'm misstating that. The film that was made about you during World War II. And another really interesting aspect of this is how you managed and how you were instrumental in getting Frank Sinatra his first movie role.
Yeah, that's one of my proudest moments. Ann Miller played my part, of course, in the movie. And I was technical advisor and had full control over the music. And between those two, that's what made the B-budget picture such an enormous success. It played around the world for 20 years, ending, strangely enough, in Japan. It was near the end of the filming. It was a B-budget, and so the big bands were recorded as they came to Los Angeles. We didn't say we want Artie Shaw and get a flight for him and the whole band and bring them out. The movie was filmed over quite a long stretch. And toward the end, they realized that they had several girl singers and not a boy singer. And the budget was almost gone, so they called me, and I already was listening to Frank Sinatra. He was then a $100 a week singer with Tommy Dorsey. They had been on film as a big band before that, but he had never been featured, really. So Columbia Pictures said, well, all these others are big names. We really should have a name singer. And I said, please, this guy is going to be a name. Please let him do one number. Well, they had to give in because that was my job.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing. The movie, his one number was Body and Soul. And
Body and Soul.
Body and Soul.
Okay.
And they did a good job of filming it. The stage, the sound stage was huge. And there were, I think, 9 beautiful women, pianists and violinists, in gorgeous gowns sitting around the set. And he would sing the song and walk by and sort of whisper a few words of the song to each lady. Well, I was thrilled when Columbia Pictures, in the wonderful mood that Hollywood had set up from the beginning, to honor the servicemen. Hollywood was the place to visit, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided to release my movie first to troops around the world, and I was thrilled to death. But
what year was that, Beverly?
That was 43.
43.
And I was advertising it. I did the film for the trailer, the advertising. Mm-hmm. I was advertising it as they were, as a big band musical.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 10 days before it was shown in this country at the Pantages Theater, word began leaking out about this singer. And when it finally showed up in Pantages. My mother and I were walking toward the theater for the premiere, and there neon lights were flashing. Sinatra's first starring picture instead of big band musical. And that launched him. And from then on, you know, it would have happened anyway, but I was so thrilled to think that my movie was sort of the time and the place for it to happen.
Well, I hope he appreciated what you did for him. Did you stay in touch with him over the years? Did he acknowledge your help and his?
Really, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, he never did. He ever acknowledge your help and his?
It was acknowledged on television.
Oh, really?
This was his. I think it was a 40th anniversary of some sort. We just happened to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, his daughter has recognized it in her biography and so forth. But this was a song made up of all the titles of all the movies he'd appeared in, and they did them chronologically. And it was kind of, I don't know whether he invented the melody, but it was kind of graceful. He sang Reveille with Beverly and made his own little theme out of it.
Hmm.
So that was a nice acknowledgement. But I guess he was a little different about his personal life with some people.
Well, now, is that film still available? Is it available on...
No, I don't know how to get it. That was, you know, that was years ago.
Right. So it may not be available at a place like Blockbuster or some other video store, I guess, as a classic.
I don't know. I think if it's possible to find anything, my producer, Dean, would have found.
Oh, really? American Movie Classics or Turner Classic Movies, they've never aired it, I take it, so.
No.
Hmm. Well, it's got to be someplace, I would think. And how did the film do? I mean, was it a fairly big success? Or
it was sensational.
Hmm.
It was a, as I said, it was a B-budget picture.
Mm-hmm.
It was the music.
Uh-huh.
And Ann's wonderful dancing that made it.
And Ann Miller played you, but you were actually offered the role first, is that right? To play yourself?
Yes, I was offered the role.
And why'd you turn that down?
You see, I don't know. It was difficult. But by that time, I had become so well established with the guys. And 5:30 in the morning, and that's when you go for makeup in the movie. And I don't know. I was rather shy anyway. And I didn't, you know... I'll always debate whether I should have or not.
You might have had a different career, Beverly. Huh?
Yes, I think I would have.
Quite possible. But Ann Miller would have, is actually a very good, I was looking at the pictures of her with you while you were filming that, and she seemed to be a very good choice, you know.
It started her career. Mm. After that, that was her first starring picture.
Oh, is that right?
And right after that, she was offered contracts. I think she took, I don't know if it was MGM or not, but it kicked off her career. As well as Sinatra's.
Hmm. Well, now, I think one of the things that I found fascinating here is that this film is notable for some of the innovations in musicals that you were responsible for.
Yes.
And tell us about those, because, I mean, I think even Duke Ellington acknowledged you.
Oh, yes. He did up to his dying day, I think. It must have been terribly frustrating for musicians, especially the great name musicians,
mm-hmm.
who when they appeared in movies... were shown in the opening few bars of the song, and the camera would then switch to a love scene or action or whatever there was. And here they were, the greatest of their group in the world. So I insisted that that the stars of my movie were going to be the singers and the musicians, and they were going to be front and center and photographed beautifully and never... left for another scene. And Duke Ellington just talked about that. He talked about it at the time in Hollywood a lot and said it was a milestone in musical movies. And when he was interviewed 10 years later in 1953, Hollywood Magazine interview,
mm-hmm.
he repeated what he had said. He said that movies have never gone back. It changed the way of movie musicals.
Hmm. And
so
of course,
I was rather proud of that.
Well, and of course, the 50s were one of the golden eras for musicals in this country.
40s, yeah.
And 40s and 50s, I guess. Well, 40s, actually. Yeah, sure.
And you know, an interesting thing about the war
mm-hmm.
that we have come to realize, the great music started in the very late 30s, but really came to its fore. I had a good selection in late 41.
Mm-hmm.
And starting in 52, the Big Band rush began to fade, and it almost seemed fortuitous that when people were away from home and needed entertainment and solace and laughs
mm-hmm.
and all those things, the music came during that period
mm-hmm.
and ended with that period.
Interesting. And that's a very interesting point. In fact, I would like to talk to you a little bit about the music of that era. But let me once again give our number to
yes.
some of our listeners so they can join us in the conversation.
Okay.
We're talking with Beverly Jean Hay, whose show Reveille with Beverly was the show for GIs during World War II. You can join us by calling 333-9455. That's here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Or from another area, 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-9455.
Yes, I'd like to talk to somebody.
Yes. well, you know, I think the music, and I think you made a very interesting point there. There was something about the music of World War II that created a kind of, I don't know what you would call it, a mood. And I believe that, as you say, it seemed to be the right music for the right time. And if you've been watching on HBO, this wonderful series produced by Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks called Band of Brothers.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? I've been reading that.
It's a wonderful show, and it follows this, it's a true story. It follows these group of men who landed in Normandy in 1944, Easy Company,
yes.
from that date, June 6, 1944, all the way in through the Battle of the Bulge and into Germany. And the music, you can see, is just such a part of that whole experience and
right.
the way the men felt connected. I think maybe that's what it was. Did it sort of connect them to their
so.
Home?
I think so.
And you were a bridge for that, obviously.
Yes.
So, I mean, the music...
And just hearing a woman's voice, they kept saying, made such a difference.
Uh-huh.
Especially early in the war, before there were any, you know, any waves and wax. At the beginning, it meant so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, are there any parallels to that kind of music today, do you think? I mean, do you feel any sense that there's that music is playing a role in this so-called new war, the war on terrorism?
That same music?
No, certainly not that music is not around.
No. I haven't heard anything about that. Of course,
mm-hmm.
this is a pretty new war. But
right.
I imagine they had, you know, in their planes and tanks, they probably have some entertainment. I'd like to find out.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a... you know, when you look at any film about that era, about World War II, you just can't watch a film without hearing the music.
And, that's right.
And the music was such an integral part of the whole, it seems like the whole process.
Mm-hmm. I don't think there'll ever be anything quite like it.
No, I think the swing era, that whole era, which if you saw the recently produced PBS special on jazz by Ken Burns,
yeah.
You noticed... the lion's share of time was spent talking about that kind of music, what they call jazz or swing jazz.
Sure.
And that was a huge chunk of our history, both in the 30s and into the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a real connection there. You know, it, as long as we're talking about the music, it would be... we have a caller on line 4. Hello, you're on with Beverly Jean Hay.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I find this so very interesting.
I mean, good morning. It's morning where I am.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, here it's afternoon.
Beverly's in California.
I see. Well, you're right. It's almost noon there then. Yeah, I'd like to know, when you did your show, did you go overseas or did you do it from
no.
the States?
No, I wanted to. It just didn't work out, and my voice was being taken overseas, so I had to kind of put up with that. But I had worked with Bob Hope. He and I were guests, two guests, at some of the graduation dances from Santa Ana Air Base when they'd have big formal affairs at Hollywood hotels, the graduating pilots. He and I would be there together, so I got close to him.
I see. Did you ever go to any of the hospitals or that kind of thing?
No. I didn't. They were mostly overseas. I've been close to veterans, you know, since then.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, what's so unique about the time is that was a special time.
certainly.
Now, the Korean War and the Vietnam War, you didn't have that kind of...
No, I did start to look into that, and it didn't seem to go anywhere.
Yeah, I don't. When Korea came, I think it was they call it the Forgotten War,
mm-hmm. right?
And I think those veterans were pretty much neglected, if I can use that term.
Yes.
The Vietnam War, on the other hand, the soldiers were met with hostility.
Right.
And those two wars, for whatever reason, slipped between the cracks. You didn't have the type of patriotism that you had in World War
uh-huh.
II.
Mm-mm.
And what's interesting today is that I've heard people compare today what happened on September the 11th.
Oh, yes, Ron and I were talking about that.
Pearl Harbor, yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, there's a parallel because we were attacked both times, right? I mean, that's...
Yes.
In Korea and Vietnam, we were not attacked.
And we don't know how long this one is going to last either. We don't know how long this war is going to last.
I don't even like to think about it.
Yeah. This is going to take quite a while, I think.
But the patriotism and the sort of everyone invests his life to helping to win in whatever way.
Yeah. I know Bob Hope is disappointed. He can't go overseas this time.
Oh, he was wonderful.
Yeah.
Just wonderful.
Yeah, he went, in three, four wars? World War II to the Persian Gulf, something like that?
Just about every war we've ever been involved in. Yeah.
Yeah, he was overseas. Uh-huh. It was in the Second World War. You know, I used to listen to the recordings, and people like Jack Benny went over and some of the others, but he's done it every time, I guess.
Thanks a lot for the call. I was just going to mention to our listeners that Beverly has worked with just about every name you could possibly imagine in the entertainment industry in the 40s, Benny Goodman and Woody Herman and Peggy Lee and Tex Beneke and Les Brown and Dinah Washington and just an incredible lineup of people.
Ella Fitzgerald,
right. An amazing group. And, of course, we mentioned Bob Hope. We have another caller on line one. Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we sure can.
I just wanted to say that she's talking about a beautiful time in our American culture history. I was a high school student in the early part of the 40s, eventually went to the Navy in 44. Hmm. But I grew up with those big bands. I'd lay in my bunk at night and turn them on, and from the Trianon Ballroom and from Santa Catalina, all these beautiful big bands. And now in my ancient age, I collect big band CDs, and every morning almost, I put them on as I'm cleaning up around the house. I relive the wonderful excitement of the big band sound. And, you know, the only thing we can get now on TV is Lawrence Welk, and I even like him. Because he has real musicians that play the good old tunes that gave you inspiration and joy and peace. And, you know, nowadays, a lot of these musical groups, the drums carry the melody.
Yeah.
Instead of having the harmony and the sequence of chords and whatnot. But you represent the great years of American musical culture that many of us look back on.
That's beautifully said.
Beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, well, thanks so much. Do you have a book out?
Not yet.
You have a record out.
We're going to have, well...
You have a CD.
I know before the end of this year.
Okay. You have a CD, Beverly, right?
I have a CD.
Mm-hmm.
It's not for sale yet.
Okay.
But we're trying to. We may have a movie made about the show too.
Oh, that'd be wonderful.
Uh huh. Well, thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the call.
It's very said the music that will tie survivors of World War II together forever.
I think that's very well said. That's exactly what's. I think you just heard that from that caller. We have another caller on line four. Hello, you're on with Beverly Jean Hay.
Morning, Beverly. I thought you might like to hear from an old listener.
Oh, I'd love it.
I used to catch you whenever I was back in rear areas. You didn't get to us up in the foxhole. We didn't have electrical outlets up there, and that was before the transistor portable radios.
Oh, yes.
But one occasion that you might be interested in, it was a few weeks after D-Day, and I was back in the Division Clearing Company with a touch of flu and pneumonia, and was lying on a cot there, and you were playing I'll Be Seeing You.
Yes.
You remember that song?
Yes.
And it just got underway when everything went kabam. One of our own fighter planes has either shot down or crashed and took out the generator.
Oh, wow.
And I never did get the end of the song as a result.
Well, maybe when she releases her CD, you can listen to it again. You know?
Right.
What is your name?
Beg pardon?
Can I have your name?
I just as soon not identify myself, thank you.
That's all right.
But
I appreciate your call.
I did enjoy you on many occasions.
Were you part of the Normandy landing?
No, fortunately, we came in a couple weeks later and didn't go into combat till 28 days after D-Day, the 8th Division.
Have you been watching Band of Brothers on HBO?
An excellent program.
It really is.
That's the most realistic of anything I've seen. It's got everything except the smells.
Yep.
Yeah.
Anybody who's been in combat knows what you're talking about. Well, I appreciate the call. That was very interesting. I'm sure it helps make Beverly's day too to hear from a caller, right? I mean, after all these years, or hear from a listener, I should say. I'm sorry.
Yes, it really is exciting. Right.
Well, you know, some of the giants of the swing era, you know, that you've interviewed and worked with. Tell us some about some of these people. I mean, you worked with Duke Ellington and Artie Shaw and Benny Goodman and Les Brown, and a lot of others. Who stands out most in your mind today, and why?
Let me think. Oh, well, there are little silly things, like when I first met Count Basie, he was in a rehearsal with his band, we're just lining him up to do the show, and he had a drink. It looked like a glass of milk on the top of the piano that he was working on while he was leading the band, and he was so, he stopped the rehearsal and was so gracious to me and said, "Would you like one of these?" And I said, "Okay." And it was delicious. It turned out to be his favorite drink that he always, always, always drank, whiskey and milk. And he lived a long time.
Yeah.
So we think maybe the milk helped.
Oh, boy.
Helped him to not suffer the fate of so many musicians.
Well, Beverly, what's on tap next? Is there, you mentioned before, possibly a film in the works?
Yes. There are a lot of, I can give you my website.
Okay, what is that?
That's www.reveille, spelled R-E-V-E-I-L-L-E, Reveille with Beverly, BEVERLY.com.
Okay.
We're just sort of coming on scene now. We've been digging. Everything takes so much time to do real, true research. And so everything that you see has actually been verified, sometimes several times over.
Well, that's fantastic.
And there's a lot of humor in it.
Well, I think I'd love to see a film made about your experiences. I think that'd be just wonderful.
I would too, and it seems sort of appropriate now somehow.
Hmm. I think we're getting close to the end here. I think we'll fade out with Tommy Dorsey and his song "I'll Be Seeing You."
Oh,
that's
thank
a wonderful.
You.
All right, and I'll tell you what. Stay online, Beverly. I'd like to talk to you a little bit afterwards. Okay.
Thank you so much for having me, Ron.
It's been a wonderful experience talking with you, and I think you bring back a lot of really good memories from a very bad time in our history. But if that's not an oxymoron,
I hope so.
Okay. Good luck to you, and keep on. Spinning those wax records, right?
I will.
All right.
Okay.
That seems to scrape out the last bit of the fine and mellow and leaves the old jukebox sagging in the middle. But it'll be loaded again and headed your way very soon. Till then, this is Beverly saying hasta luego, and I'll be seeing you.